Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Swing and a line drive, base hit right field. Max Scherzer has done it again.
Do you believe it, Howie Kendrick, part two?
The celebration is on. The Washington Nationals are the world.
You know, sometimes when we do a podcast, you say it's loaded. We got a lot to talk about. We exaggerate. I'll be honest. At times, we maybe hype. We're not hyping it up this time. Buster Olney of ESPN. Barry Zwerluga joins us as well. We have a loaded Nats Talk podcast today. Of course, Todd Dybas, Chase Hughes, Nick Ashew with you, as usual. Before we get to Buster and before we get to Barry, the Nationals, of course, finishing up the draft much shorter this time around. It's only five rounds. We know everything's different right now, the draft to everything going on in baseball. But let's just kind of look at this as a whole, guys. You happy with what they did? You know, they go pitcher once again early on because that's what the Nats seem to love to do is build up their farm system when it comes to pitching. How do you feel about it?
Yeah, not surprised at all. As he said, a college pitcher, Cade Cavalli in the first round. Another college pitcher, a younger guy, a sophomore, Cole Henry, second round, and then kind of just stocking up what you can in the truncated five-round draft. But the Nationals have taken a starting pitcher just about every year since 2011, and they haven't had a lot of return from them as of yet. Obviously, Lucas Giolito was the huge prospect in all of that, and then was sent to the White Sox along with Dane Dunning, another pitcher that they took during that time. But Eric Fetty has the most WAR of any Nationals draft pick since Anthony Rendon, any Nationals
wow.
draft pick. Yes, and he has one WAR, 1.0. So career WAR. So they are taking swings here. They need to take more swings, and they need to find one of these pitchers, hopefully in their case, two of these pitchers who eventually pan out. Max Scherzer is in the second to last year of his contract. And so basically this season's over for Scherzer and he's heading into the final year, right? And 5 years from now, Steven Strasburg probably will be a dial down Steven Strasburg. And obviously Patrick Corbin's clock is running too. And so somebody sometime is going to have to come from within as these guys kind of age out. And the Nationals are trying to increase their chances of doing that, especially since it hasn't happened lately.
That stat about the Nationals drafting is so great because it's within the context of them just winning a World Series, right? And it kind of goes to show what the MLB draft is, which is such a crapshoot. And you often don't hear about these guys again until years later. So we could tell you about Cade Cavalli. I mean, he's 6'4". He can touch 98 with his fastball, and that sounds good. But it also sounds like a lot of other guys they've drafted recently, right?
Yeah.
This is the fifth college pitcher the Nats have taken in their last seven first-round picks. And three of the previous four haven't reached the big leagues yet. There's been some injuries. There's been some recency, of course, with Jackson Rutledge. But what's interesting is that when you're picking college pitchers, right, the idea there, because they went to college, is that they should be on the fast track to the majors. But that has not been the case. And I actually looked at, you know, Mike Rizzo's drafting history. 10 of the 14 first-round picks he spent on players have been pitchers. Some of the position players have been some of his best picks, right? Like Bryce Harper and Anthony Rendon, and we'll see about Carter Kieboom. And you mentioned the irony of starting pitching still being a relative weakness in their farm system after all of this, and it's kind of amazing. But if you do look at recent drafts, there is evidence to suggest that if you do pick college pitchers, it's much more likely they'll get to the majors than a high school pitcher. I looked at 2016, that was the year the Nationals drafted Carter Kieboom. 15 pitchers were taken in the first round that year. Seven have made it, and all seven were college pitchers. So you have to think that, like, at some point they're going to get this right. Maybe it's Cade Cavalli. I don't know. If you look at his stats in college, I wouldn't say they're all that impressive. It's more of an upside thing. You know, it's his build. It's how hard he throws. It's the type of stuff that you're not going to glean from Baseball Reference. So I guess we'll see if they're right with this one.
Yeah, and you're doing 5 rounds versus 40 rounds, which is certainly a unique position baseball was in this year compared to the past, where you have so many more opportunities to take guys in the 27th round. And, you know, every once in a while, these guys pan out and become something. You really got to dig down in your research a little bit more and really decide on who you want to take. JC, it's funny you bring up a good point. Like, we think of, like, the NBA draft and the NFL draft, and it's like, you know, you see these guys, then they're out there right away that first year, and they're like, you don't see some of these guys, if ever, for – sometimes 2, 3, 4 years, depending on how long it takes them to get through the minor leagues. And you know, certain baseball certainly has a very deep and robust minor league system, even with some of the, you know, the teams that they're going to be losing. But you then almost forget about some of these players that are drafted until you have, look, you have some of the few, like, you know, a Bryce Harper or Steven Strasburg, clearly, who come up through the system early and everybody's talking about them from the moment they're drafted. But most of the time, that's not the case.
Yeah. And this is the cyclical thing, too. If you're going to win all the time at the big league level, your farm system is going to take some hits progressively, right, while you wait for these guys to come. Because you're going to start drafting in the 20s. You're not in the top five all the time anymore. And then you use those assets. You're either, like, they didn't draft Juan Soto and Victor Robles, but they brought them up immediately, right? Those guys would be in the farm system and obviously would completely skew their farm system rankings if you have – Juan Soto and Victor Robles hanging out in AA at this point, but they're up because they're aggressive with bringing them up. And Lucas Giolito and Dane Dunning, they're in Chicago because they wanted an everyday player because they thought Harper would leave, and so they had a replacement kind of in their pocket for him. So they moved that asset because they're winning. Teams who are not winning would not be doing that. So it's not just to, like, pick on the Nationals for who they have selected and how it's panned out necessarily. And when we're talking about the current state of their farm system, it's not surprising. And as Chase was saying, you know, they hope that one of these guys is going to pan out. And, you know, who knows at this point. Like, the 2018 pick was a high school pitcher, Mason Denneberg. When's the last time we thought about him? That was 2 years ago. He got hurt. We were at spring training this year when spring training was still in its normal stages. He was nowhere to be seen. Like, I threw a question in during a Mike Rizzo scrum, and almost the other reporters were like, why are we even asking about that guy right now? But Mason Denneberg and Seth Romero, they both got hurt, right? And these are guys that they need to have something happen with. Something. I mean, even if they have to convert them to the bullpen, something needs to come out of your first-round picks at least once every 5 years, no matter where you're drafting. You need to get some value out of there in some manner.
And those guys are first-round picks, and no one was thinking to ask the GM about the recent first-round picks, too. I would say the Dodgers are the only team that can really circumvent that norm of, like, picking in the late 20s and consistently finding stars. It's pretty amazing. But I don't know how the Major League Baseball draft can ever get over the fact, in terms of interest, that you kind of have to stow these names away for 3, 4 years down the road. But I would like to see drafts, draft trades on draft night of draft picks. You know, you can't just, like, swap the 5th pick for the 9th pick with another player like you can in another sport. And then also, if international players were included, I think that would make it a lot more interesting, because what's weird about the MLB draft is a lot of the best players aren't even eligible to be drafted, like a Juan Soto. Now, if that system was in place, then the Nationals maybe wouldn't have Juan Soto right now. So certainly it's worked out for the Nationals in some regards.
Yeah, and I doubt Cade Cavalli is going to have the same type of hype when he makes his major league debut that Strasburg had 10 years ago. But then again, I think we realize that that was such a unique situation. Are we finally closer to baseball actually coming back? We're going to ask ESPN's Buster Olney next. And we welcome in ESPN's Buster Olney, of course, also the host of the Baseball Tonight with Buster Olney podcast. Let's jump into what Rob Manfred said the other day on SportsCenter First, Buster, because clearly we're in one of the biggest labor disputes baseball's ever had, but it's a whole different world. It's not something that we've, you know, seen in the past, given the circumstances around the world. But Manfred said that he's 100% confident there is going to be baseball this season. I would clearly expect him to say that. There's plenty of back and forth going on. How close do you think we actually are to that being a reality?
I don't think we're far from them reaching an agreement, because, as you guys have seen, they're edging slowly toward the middle. And so I wouldn't be surprised if the next few days, if you hear about, you know, a 70 game season with full prorated salaries for the players. And my immediate question, if in fact they reach an agreement, will be, where were you guys 6 weeks ago? Because even if they reach an agreement now, the damage done is already there. You know, they've already squandered opportunity to not have the sporting stage all themselves at the beginning of July. And the other thing, too, is that if it's just an agreement to play this year, they've done nothing to address the larger issues that they're going to be talking about in 2021. I've been shocked at the lack of leadership on both sides.
Buster, you just stole my question, because I was going to say, when spring training stopped, if I told you that on June 12th, we would still be talking about these guys not having anything resolved, what would your reaction be? But we just learned that you're as flabbergasted, I think, as everybody else. What do you think has been resolved, and then what do you think can be quickly resolved in order to get this over with? Do you think the players are going to come off the 100% of their prorated, or do you think Manfred's going to give in there but just reduce the games? How do you think the merger is finally going to happen?
Yeah, I think it's going to be the owners, as it should have been, because they're the entity with a larger pile of money. They're going to wind up agreeing on a number of games, not the 119 that the players proposed, but less, and I think it's going to be about 70. And the players aren't going to come off their full pro rata. But the problem is, as I say, that even if the players win in this moment, there's nothing built on moving forward for either side. So it's going to be just a temporary solution. And if there's not a vaccine for the coronavirus, they're going to be right back next February having the same conversations, Todd.
Buster, there's obviously several issues at play here. One is safety. One is revenue. And then I guess secondarily is what these plans do from a baseball perspective. And say there is a season that, you know, falls somewhere around half of what a normal season would be. What do you think that would do baseball-wise to the results of the game, and which teams do you think could benefit?
Well, first off, and we know this, because there's going to be a need for a second spring training, that the starting pitchers are not going to be up to full speed. You're going to see a lot of games that are won and lost with the depth of relief pitchers. I think that when we see the nature of the expanded rosters for all the teams, they're just going to be a ton of relievers. So, for example, you know, the Washington Nationals, in a typical season, we'd say, well, their theoretical advantage is their starting pitching. I think those type of teams early will be playing catch up. I think the teams that have great roster depth are going to be the teams with an advantage. The Yankees, the Tampa Bay Rays, I think, are going to be very dangerous. And always the Dodgers, because the Dodgers, you know, besides being a big market team, have done a great job of fostering you know, those great bargain ads like a Chris Taylor, like a Max Muncy. So those three teams jump to mind for me.
You know, there's been a lot of conversation clearly about money, and we know that any situation like this certainly comes down to money. Baseball's a business like any other sport. But, you know, there is a long list of safety rules and restrictions that were talked about. And that was sort of the discussion early on, and now it's all evolved to how much money everybody's going to get. But are the players eventually going to be on board with all of these restrictions that baseball has essentially put in place for when they hopefully do get back out on the field?
Well, and yours is absolutely a great point, because you're right. Early on, the conversation was about the safety. And then the reality all along has been the Mount Everest in these negotiations have been the money. If, in fact, there is a resolution there and you actually have some collaboration, some cooperation, then it increases the likelihood the two sides will work out the safety stuff. You know, I've said all along, I feel like that the worst case scenario for Major League Baseball would be no season at all. The second worst case scenario would be a situation where the commissioner, in lieu of an agreement with the players, tries to ram a season down the throat of the players, because then the health and safety stuff could be a major stumbling block, where if the players feel like, you know what, they didn't really work with us on the length of the season and we're going to be passive aggressive here, my goodness, there are going to be a lot of nooks and crannies to hide behind. You know, and you'd have to say, I mean, we're seeing in recent days, you know, spikes in the coronavirus infections in various parts of the country, that there is inevitably probably going to be a situation where there are infections within clubhouses, and how the two sides resolve that and what they agree to about, you know, do you move the team? Do you shut down a clubhouse? Does one team's schedule get suspended? Those would be interesting details. As I say, I think if they can agree on the money part of it, then that increases the likelihood they'll be able to work that out as well.
Buster, we have seen some folks take to social media who don't usually use social media. And one of those is Max Scherzer, who is obviously a crucial voice in the union, being part of the eight-player executive subcommittee, going to the Hall of Fame, being a prominent person in baseball in 2020 and beyond. When you see someone like that speak out on social media, it was like 2 years before he composed an original tweet, and his original tweet ends up being that we're not giving back any money. And then he follows up the other day by comparing the owner's stance about cash flow issues to cash flow issues for Amazon and the semantics of valuation and net profit and those sorts of things. So when you see Max doing that, kind of what's your reaction, and what have you thought about the union leadership during this process?
About 4 weeks ago, Tom Glavine, who is one of the faces of the players in 94, 95 in that strike, did an interview with the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. And I felt like Tom, who's not a sledgehammer personality, he was almost trying to send a message to both sides, where he talked about how he did so many interviews during the 94, 95 strike. And by the way, the players in that instance, and I was covering baseball at that time, they clearly had the high ground. They clearly were in the right in this fight against the owners. And Tom said that he did interviews all over the place. He was trying to convince people of their side of the argument. And what he realized after was it didn't help at all. Like, you know, people didn't want to hear it. And keep in mind that that was at a time of relative prosperity. You didn't have 40 million people out of work. You didn't have all the lives lost. You didn't have everything that's happened since George Floyd was killed, which is why, you know, while there certainly a lot of what Max has tweeted out, you know, all of what Max tweeted out, there's truth in it. There's truth in what Blake Snell said. There might be some elements of truth to what various owners have said. Nobody wants to hear it in the current context. And it's been shocking, but not shocking, that the two sides just haven't kept all of the discussions behind closed doors. You know, Max is one of my favorites. He's a legitimate perspective. I just don't think it's helped either side to have this stuff spill out into the public forum.
I hear you on that, Buster. I feel like the optics have been terrible, honestly. But this week was the MLB draft. And I'm curious, I'm sure you've watched many of these over the years. If you could make any changes to it, what would you change?
First off, I like the fact that, you know, and it only came out of this situation where there was no other active sports going on. I like the fact that it got center stage. You know, it got the power of ESPN, and there was a lot of attention to it. I wish that the context had been different. I wish the conversation had been different around it, so that going into the first round, you don't have Rob Manfred saying in so many words, you know what, I'd be willing to ram, you know, a system down the throats of the players. We would mandate a system. You know, I talked yesterday to Kylie McDaniel. He does a great job for us in the draft coverage. And I said, how much, as you were in the middle of this, did it feel like the labor stuff loomed over it? And he acknowledged it absolutely did. Carl Ravitch, my colleague at ESPN, after the draft coverage finished last night, he wrote on Twitter, I love baseball, but I don't like it very much right now. I would love to see in the future the type of coverage we saw the last couple of days with, you know, 10 hours, and we got to see a lot of rounds, but I just wish we could have seen it in a different context. My hope is that moving forward, that's what we would see.
You know, it's funny. There's so much comparison now to what's going on with baseball to the 94 strike season and how long it took for really the fans to come back. And, you know, we look at the 1998 season, and of course, Sunday at 9, you've got the new 30 for 30, long gone summer. Mark McGwire, Sammy Sosa, their chase for the home run record. We'll see that on ESPN. We get to hear from McGwire. We get to hear from Sosa. It's really the first time they've both kind of talked at length about this. When you look back on that season, what do you remember about it?
I was covering the Yankees for the New York Times at that time. I was a beat writer, and I remember how into it the players were. Like, because the Cubs, you know, play a lot of their games in the afternoon at Wrigley Field, you know, going into the Yankees clubhouse before a game, and every time Sammy came to the plate, they were locked in. And then after games, when the clubhouse doors open and McGwire would be coming up for the Cardinals someplace around the country, all the players being locked into it. There was so much excitement. You know, one weekend, the Times sent me down to do some a piece on McGuire, and the excitement around batting practice, my goodness. I mean, that was all legitimate. Now, I will tell you that as a reporter covering the sport at the time, you know, a lot of people have said, well, the writers, you know, they didn't want to talk about the steroid stuff. They wanted to keep the party going. Let me tell you, if I could have broken that story, if I could have found proof, I would have loved to have done that. It's pretty clear, and I've thought so much about this through the years, you know, what I as a reporter blew was the fact that we were trying to focus so much on let's prove that player X is doing it or player Y is doing it. I wish that we had done more general stories, quoting players speaking generally about the steroid issue and how prevalent they thought it was at the time. Because guys, like when I would walk into a clubhouse, there would be two coffee pots. One would be marked with a piece of tape and the other wouldn't. And one was considered to be leaded and unleaded. That one had the amphetamines in it and one didn't. And that was pretty open. And so as I was watching this play out and seeing bodies grow during that time, you knew something was going on, but it was a little bit like watching Lance Armstrong in 2001, 2002, 2003. You know it's going on, but you can't prove it. And that, for me, was always below the surface.
Buster, you recently talked to a handful of guys who gave up some home runs to to McGuire and Sosa, not a very exclusive club, certainly, at the time. What did they have to say about dealing with them at the plate at that time? And were any of them irritated after the fact all these years later that, you know, the competitive field was not balanced?
Yeah, there were 17 guys that year who allowed home runs to both. I talked with five of them, and you heard some really funny and interesting stories. For example, Rick Reed, I asked him, he pitched for the Mets, and I asked him, what was it like to face McGuire? He said, you know, he looked like King Kong up there, and he said that all that went through his mind when he pitched to McGuire was, please don't hit the ball up the middle. Please don't hit the ball up the middle. And I asked him, I said, so did that, Reader, did that, like, prevent you from pitching the outside corner? He goes, absolutely. Like, he just lived in fear when McGuire was at the plate of that happening. You know, stories that I heard from guys like Andy Bennis about the autographs that McGuire provided for other players, those are really cool. And Todd, just to answer the last part of your question, that surprised me a little bit. Now, five is not a big sample size, but I thought there would be more anger, more bitterness that, look, like the you hear from the, you know, the 2018 and 17 Dodgers, like they had something taken away from them from the Astros sign stealing. I thought more players would feel that way. But one of them that I talked to, Willie Blair, said that when he was a player, like it bothered him a lot that PEDs were being used. He said, but as time has gone on, he's kind of gotten to a place where he feels like, you know what, that's just the way baseball was back then. Jim Parquet, his first two homers allowed in the big leagues were to Sosa and McGuire in 1998 when he was with the White Sox. And he said that, you know, he looks back and you know, he feels like, you know what, I'm honored that I was part of history at that time. I think their perspective is kind of shifting the way that he did for Ralph Branca, who allowed the, you know, that famous home run by Bobby Thompson in 1951. And by the end of his life, he was doing card signings with Bobby Thompson and embracing his part of history in a moment that everybody remembers.
You know, the reason why I'm excited to watch this documentary is because I remember it vividly, but also there's been nothing like it since in the decades that have passed. But now in baseball, we're seeing home run records broken all over the place and, of course, 162-game seasons. What are the chances we see anything like that ever again? And is there a player that you would bet on to push 60 homers or more?
It was funny when Rick Reed was talking about, you know, that aspect. Said, no one will ever do that again, except for maybe Pete Alonso. He might hit 2,000 in a season, right? He and Aaron Judge would be guys that you would look at possibly doing that. After what we saw last year, I feel like I can't answer your question until we know what the composition of baseball is, you know, because the numbers jumped up so much. I think we learned last year that whatever's being done behind the scenes with the baseball, whether it's incremental or intentional or whatever it is going to play such a factor into whether or not that happens again. I tend to err on the side of, you know, the players, generally speaking, as time goes on, they're bigger and faster and stronger than their peers. So it wouldn't shock me if it happened again, But I am curious when baseball resumes in 2020, what the baseball will be like and how far it'll travel.
Long Gone Summer debuts Sunday at 9 on ESPN. I know my DVR said I've been looking forward to this for a long time since we heard that it was coming out. Buster, really appreciate the time. Thanks for coming on with us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, guys.
But we also got a chance to talk to Barrios Verlugo, the Washington Post, including his own Nationals what ifs.
Right now we're kind of in the middle of, I guess it's called What If Week. I don't really know if we have like a real name for it, but we're looking at different things in Nationals history and just looking back and saying, what if, you know, what if something had gone differently? And there's obviously a million scenarios there, and it's a lot more fun when the team has also won a World Series. But when you look back on the Nationals history, what's the biggest what if moment for you?
Well, I mean, I'll quickly get to one, which is like, what if Howie's ball in the seventh inning of game seven goes to the right of the foul pole and doesn't clank off it? That would be different. But the one that sticks out to me always is the ninth inning of game five, the 2012 NLDS against the Cardinals. Drew Storen was the closer. They went into the inning with a 7-5 lead. He got two outs with a man on second, with Carlos Beltran on second. And so they're one out away, and then they're one strike away with Yadier Molina at the plate. There was a 2-2 pitch that Molina took. It was below the strike zone. It wouldn't have been egregious if it was called a strike. Thorne walked him. David Freese is up next. He had a 1-2 pitch that was right at the bottom of the zone that Freese laid off. I think that no one in St. Louis Cardinals history would be aggrieved about that punch out if the home plate umpire had in fact called Freese out on strikes. Instead, Storen loses Freese. The Cardinals rally for four runs that inning. The Nationals lose 9-7. And there's a whole bunch of trickle downs that happen from there. Rafael Soriano would never have been signed as the closer. The Nationals wouldn't have been burdened with that kind of label of they can never deliver in the postseason. A lot of things changed that night because those calls did not go Storen in the Nats' way.
Barry, one of the things on our list is, what if Bryce Harper re-signed here? What do you think the levers would be? To me, obviously, that means that they have to move Eaton, and then a few other things probably happen accordingly there. What would you see the trickle-down effect if Bryce came back here for 13 years and then now he's here forever, fulfilling what he argued was his personal preference to sign somewhere long-term, be there, and kind of and establish himself in that manner?
Well, I think a couple things. I mean, a lot of people last year, you know, wanted to link A and B. Did the Nationals win because Bryce Harper left? I have a tough time marrying those two. And we look at them now as the 2019 World Series champion Washington Nationals, but that's what they were. But they were down 3-1 to Josh Hader and the Brewers in the wildcard game, and things could have gone a number of different ways. The thing that I think fit the Nationals of last year and last October that Bryce might not have fit is they really put the baseball in play. They kind of bucked the trend of, you know, the three true outcomes. They didn't mind giving up a batter to move a runner. They put some pressure on the defense because they did put the ball in play so much. And Bryce, you know, he's probably good for your 35 homers and 100 RBIs, which he had for the Phillies last year, but he's going to strike out 190 or 200 times. And that, you know, how much would that have disrupted their offense last year? You're right, Todd. You know, obviously Eaton wouldn't be here. Your outfield for the foreseeable future would be Robles, Soto, and Harper. I can't say that that's a bad looking outfield. it's a really, really interesting debate because they did win the whole thing the first year he was gone.
Obviously, Bryce Harper's free agency and his departure was talked about a lot. Todd Divas still says we should talk about it more. He misses that time, believe it or not. But do you think there's a what if from Nationals history that maybe has gone a little underrated that you would argue was maybe a bigger what if that more hinged on it than maybe people give it credit for?
Well, I mean, I think if we were having this discussion last offseason, I would have been like, why couldn't they get the deal done with Dusty Baker and have some consistency in the managerial chair? Now, Dave Martinez has kind of kicked that can down the road because I think what he did in the clubhouse and outside the dugout, not necessarily pulling strings during the game, showed that he has a pretty good handle on things. I wonder, you know, what are we going to look back on when they didn't sign Anthony Rendon? I also think a little bit of a sleeper now is, what if they hadn't signed Strasburg to that first extension. That really married the club to the pitcher. At that point, I think the fan base was still a little bit torn about Strasburg. They're not torn about him now, as best I can tell. And he is a World Series MVP who I think is just about everything anybody could have hoped for him when they drafted him, with a future ahead of him. If they hadn't signed him to that first extension and locked him down, I'm not sure he'd still be a National. I'm not sure that he would have been pitching in that World Series last year. And I think he would have been enhancing his reputation someplace else.
Yeah, I do want to get to one more with this because it is something I'm writing about. So I just want your opinion on this. But there was a few years ago, there were rumors that, you know, Mike Rizzo could have gone to Arizona. I think the Blue Jays were a team that was mentioned too at one point. Like, he's been so important, obviously, to the construction of this team and eventually winning a World Series. How could things have gone differently if, let's say, years ago, Rizzo was not back? I mean, how different would this team maybe have been?
Well, and we're talking about this at a time when this doesn't seem like it matters, but eventually it will. I mean, Rizzo is in a lame duck year, the year after winning a World Series. His contract ends after this season. So that'll be a topic that'll come up again. Mike Rizzo has offered consistency in leadership at the top. And if you go and look at his, particularly his trade record, it's really a pretty remarkable one. You know, there are now, people might pick apart the Eaton trade because Giolito has become an all-star in Chicago with the White Sox, and we still don't know what Reynaldo Lopez will develop into in that deal as well. But Eaton's a World Series champion, and if you watch Game 6 and 7, he certainly played a big role in those, so it's hard to argue there. It's hard for me to imagine where the Nationals would turn if Mike Rizzo wasn't their GM. I'm not sure who even would be making that call. They've never really replaced Stan Kasten as kind of a president figure. In fact, Mike Rizzo is the president of baseball operations. So yes, I think that's a place where if they hadn't gotten those previous deals done with Rizzo, things could have changed and changed pretty dramatically. They've got one more deal to get with him, done with him to make sure that doesn't happen again.
Barry, it seems like it was a few months ago at this point because so much is changing every day in sports and in the world. But I'd love to hear your reaction to the Nationals World Series rings and the design that they unveiled. Obviously, the ceremony didn't go as we thought it would, but always interesting to see a championship ring, right?
Yeah, and this one, I mean, I haven't studied rings before, but it certainly met the moment. They embraced every single piece of the individuality that was the 2019 Nationals. Go 1-0 today, finish the fight, all of those things. Shark. Nobody who was a part of that season as a fan, a player, a coach, an observer will forget those little details. And you know, those things are gaudy by nature, but they managed to make the gaudiness pretty individually tailored to the 2019 Nats. That was pretty cool.
What do you make of Scott Boras's involvement with this? Are you surprised at all that he came out and basically told the players, you know, not to cave? Because it did make somebody like Trevor Bauer not very happy that he did that.
Yeah, Scott is obviously in the midst of all of this because he has so many, prominent clients. He is somebody who not only thinks about his clients, but thinks about the game as a whole. He's not a, you know, he's got a big enough stable and he's done it long enough and he's a prominent, powerful enough voice. You could argue that he's the second or third most, you know, powerful person in baseball, that he's not going to stand to the side. I think you see the stuff that he's saying publicly. I also think he is working very closely with the union on, hey guys, have you thought of this? What do you think about this? Can we get more games? Because if we play more games, that would be more money. What about being willing to push it into December so that we can increase the revenue as well? He is not going to sit idly by and hope other people work it out. He's going to be right in the middle of it because he's got a lot of clients that rely on him to do that, and because he thinks about the sport as a whole.
Barry, what do you miss about going to the park or the press box?
I mean, I'd take those elevator delays, Todd, right now. I'd take right. I'd take an extra long waiting outside the clubhouse, wondering whether there's a team meeting going on. I'd take two rain delays in a 14-inning game, walking out of there at 1:30 or something. I walked down there at the day of the home opener and didn't really know if I would feel anything, and it honestly bummed me out. there were three flags, flagpoles kind of to the left of the giant scoreboard in center field. And they had the flags flying for 1924, 1925, 1933, the Senators' three pennants. And then there was a fourth flagpole that was barren that they were clearly going to raise that 2019 flag up on. A lot of stuff to miss. Makes me, you know, kind of regret ever grumbling about, well, I got to go down to the ballpark tonight. That would not even cross my mind right now.
Same. Yeah, Barry, I think it's safe to say we miss all of this right now. Like, it would be nice to just have it be back to being baseball again. And, you know, hopefully we'll get to some semblance of that very soon. Really appreciate the time. Thanks for coming on with us.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me, guys.
Thanks to Buster. Thanks to Barry, of course, joined us on this podcast. Parting shots, it's really all we have time left for. I know, Todd, you had nothing last time. Well, wait, I'll give you a chance because Chase gets really mad when you don't have anything. Chase, your parting shot, sir.
Well, this one actually is dedicated to Todd. I noticed last night or during the MLB draft throughout the course of it, the Nationals, every time they picked a player, they said, the World Series champion Nationals select. This was on their Twitter account. And Todd, I know, is a big fan of their Twitter account. And it made me realize with no baseball, it means that they can keep doing this, right? We're in June of the following year, and they're still referencing the fact that they're World Series champions, like literally in every single tweet. And if the 2020 season was in the middle of, if baseball was going on, I have to imagine they wouldn't be doing this. But because there's no baseball, they can continue. And I decided to look up how many times they've referenced themselves as World Series champions in tweets. And they won the World Series 226 days ago. They've used the phrase World Series champions 184 times in tweets, 185 if you include their statement on social justice, which, by the way, shoehorned it in. And then they've also used other phrases like World Series champ and World Series champs. My total, as I calculate it, is 196 references in 226 days of them being World Series champions.
You need a hobby, Chase. This is ridiculous.
The context of some of them are amazing. It'll be like their PA announcer, and they'll reference him as World Series champion PA announcer or World Series champion team chef. The creativity, I think they deserve some points for.
Well, the good thing is you're allowed to get out of the house now, so hopefully you'll take advantage of that because clearly you've been inside for far too long. Todd, I doubt you've done the same research that Chase did for something like that.
Yeah, no, I have not done that. And frankly, I find that total to be low considering how insufferable that account is.
By the way, angry Todd is one of my favorite things on earth because it's very subtle, but yet it always just pokes at somebody and it makes me very happy.
So other than that, I don't have a parting shot, Nick.
Yes.
I don't.
Chase, how do you feel about this? Are you okay? He has nothing?
I miss Todd's parting shots. I want to know, how is this power washing and deck building going?
The deck is complete and there are more projects to come. I feel like during last season, a lot of my parting shots revolved around how much I ate in the press box that day. And so...
So you're thrown off by all this?
Yeah, with that source of information lacking, I'm not sure what to talk about if I can't pontificate about the gigantic meals I have during baseball games.
Just eat something and then tell us about that. That'll be your new thing. Just cook something new and then we'll make it a whole thing about
chef. Wait, Todd. Yeah. Tell us quickly about you played basketball the other day.
Oh, that's right. Did he play basketball though? I think we're gonna put this in quotes real
yeah,
quick.
Yeah, I was gonna say that needs some air quotes because I was dribbling up and down a court that did not have rims on either end. Just the backboards, and like practicing doing release drills and dribbling drills and roasting
outlet passes.
Yeah, and there was nobody there, and I was like, just put a rim on here. There's no one in this entire park. All I want is a rim. That's all I want this summer.
Todd, I've got a hoop in my neighborhood or a full court in my neighborhood that has hoops. So if you want to come out here and get it be a socially distanced basketball game, we can make that happen. So.
Perfect.
All right, make sure you subscribe to the National Stock Podcast if you haven't yet. Thanks to Barry's Verluga and Buster Olney. We'll talk to you next time.